Hello, everybody. It's Jan Rutherford with Self-Reliant Leadership. This is my 42nd LinkedIn Live, or now what we call office hours. And today I'm really excited to bring on Sarah Cannaday. And Sarah, as many of you know, is a very popular LinkedIn learning author. She's got 16 courses out there. And I think her most popular course, and she'll correct me, is Organizational Culture. And she's now the author of 3 books, started with You, According to Them, Leadership Unchained, and now her latest book is Coaching Essentials for Managers, The Tools You Need to Ignite Greatness in Each Employee. And here is Sarah. Did I get it all right?
You are very close. The most popular course on LinkedIn Learning is How to Transition from Manager to Leader.
I bet it's over 500,000.
It has reached 1 million views.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Well, hey, tell my kids that, please.
Well, hey, let me get this book up. And I'm going to cover our faces a little bit. And
okay.
That's your newest book. It's just out by McGraw-Hill. I'm so excited you told me about it. And we're able to share what you've learned over a whole bunch of years about what's essential for coaching. And so before we get started, I just want to remind everybody, hey, if you're listening, we would love to know where you're listening from. So, you know, in LinkedIn or wherever, just put in where you're listening from. I'm in Denver and Sarah's in Austin. And also, as we get going, if you've got any questions at all, put them in there and we'll try to get to those. So, Sarah, before we get started, the one thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, what's not in the bio? What's something about you that somebody's not going to learn through your website or through LinkedIn?
Oh, that I have always had a secret desire to be a backup dancer in a hip hop video. True.
Wow. And, true. And you haven't, and that hasn't happened yet.
It has not happened yet. that's something people don't know about me.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you like to dance, obviously.
I do. And, you know, don't get the opportunity very often unless, you know, I put my own music on, and that tends to be rare, you know, right? Yeah. We're moving around and doing things, but every once in a while, weddings,
yeah,
major parties, right? If there's a DJ, I'm there.
Well, you're a lot more fun than me, because I was just at a wedding, and when the dancing started, I went to the back with my grandson, and we played chess on my phone.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. All right, we got a lot of people from here, El Paso, Pennsylvania, Connecticut. My friend Andy is who just left the military as an Air Force colonel, is calling in from Florida. We've got people from Cairo, Portugal, all over. So thank you all for being here. You draw a big crowd, Sarah. That's awesome. and again, let us know whatever questions you have as we get going. So first off, coaching essentials. Why is this important now, given everything else going on?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would tell you that if you picked up any article or study right now, most companies are grappling with the great resignation, with quiet quitting, and they're trying to discover ways to keep employees loyal and engaged, right? Yep. And one of, I would say, 3 of the top strategies to do that is to help your employees feel like they're progressing, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that means different things to different people. We hear that and we think that means that employees want the next thing. They want a promotion, but that's not necessarily true. Studies have found that really employees just want to feel like they're progressing, even if it means growing right where they're planted. So learning new things, getting an opportunity to experience something new, represent the company at a conference, be part of a project that is never been discussed or tried. Being connected with people who do more of what they want to do and what connects them to the meaning of their work. So coaching right now is critical.
Yeah. Well, to me, what you're saying ties into, you know, one of the things we know about what motivates people, and that's the ability to develop mastery, to, you know, to, for growth and development, and probably more important than ever. And I think, you know, I'm wondering what your take is on, you know, what that means to people. And you know, a few decades ago, what mastery meant and growth meant was promotion. And that's not necessarily the case today, right?
No. In fact, if I think about a leader, for example, their role, what I love to see is leaders who come to the conclusion that mastering their role is not about getting a bigger department to manage, right? Having more people under them, or a bigger budget to manage, or a title that's more coveted. It's when they realize that it's growing others, potentially other leaders, is what mastering their job looks like, right? So leadership is just a prime example of where there's a disconnect between what we think people want and what really gratifies them at work.
Yeah. Well, you know, in your book, you talk a little bit about managing, mentoring, training, coaching. You know, what's the difference in all this? How do you define coaching?
Yeah, well, I think coaching really can and typically is a dance between all of those things. So in one coaching conversation, for example, you can be doing a little bit of instructing, teaching. You could be doing a little bit of mentorship. And that's where we get into, well, here's what I experienced years ago, and here's how I handled it, and here was the outcome. If it's helpful, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's even a little bit of consulting where you go into providing a little bit of the how-to. Now, let me preface by saying you shouldn't necessarily start there. You should endeavor to start as a pure coach. And that's where you're helping other people discover either what's meaningful to them, what a solution might look like, because that's where the real development and learning happens. Right. Yeah. So maybe you start there and then you dance between the others.
Yeah. I like the phrase where you help people discover. I've got a question already coming in from Greg, and let me pop this up. And Greg is, you know, I see Greg on my LinkedIn feed all the time. Greg, and I think you're out of Dublin and Cork. Or between Dublin and Cork. So Greg's question is, you know, should we have an internal coach or an external coach? And who's the book written for more? You know, people that are in jobs that might be player coaches, or people that are hired, you know, to come into a company and purely coach?
Both great questions. My original intent was to write the book for leader coaches, right? So leaders within organizations, entrepreneurial leaders who have staff. But really, the content is applicable whether you're an internal coach or an external coach, right? Yeah. It really is. It's not tied only to internal leader coaches. And then to his second question, which is better, internal or external coaching? You know, I think they both have their benefits and maybe their drawbacks. In terms of benefits, if you have an internal coach, they know the landscape. They know the culture. They know how things are done, right? Mm-hmm. And so their perspective and their context may be easier to understand. However, they also might be biased. They may not give you an outsider's perspective, which in a lot of cases, I think is really helpful. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it just depends. Coaching is very situational too. Sometimes there are things that are appropriate for you to ask a peer or an internal leader, and sometimes it's appropriate to seek outside advice by a trusted advisor.
Yeah. When you start coaching, do you think it's important to basically talk about, you know, what kind of coaching this will be, you know, whether it be performance or developmental or career or corrective? I mean, do you think that we need to really call it out at the beginning, that here's what it is, here's what it isn't, for a particular engagement?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I tend to, and this is reflected in the book, I tend to see coaching as either performance coaching, mm-hmm. which can include sort of corrective coaching, instructional coaching, getting somebody to improve something they're doing, and then developmental coaching. Right? I put them sort of in those two buckets. And developmental coaching is helping somebody either better match to the skills that bring them more meaning in their role, looking to improve their soft and technical skills to arm mm-hmm. them for a future role. That would be developmental coaching. Yeah. But what's interesting is I offer a framework in my book that's used for both.
Yeah.
And because of that, I don't think you need to name it up front.
Yeah.
You know, today I want to talk to you and we're, you know, this is going to be about performance coaching.
Yeah.
I just think if you have a framework to use, a step, in my case, it's 5 steps, you're really just approaching it the same way. It's just a difference between what the topic is and where you're directing them, but you continue to use some of the same skill sets and the same framework.
Yeah. Let me pop up another question we just got in from Ergun. Why do people need coaching? Can everyone be their own coach? What's the biggest obstacle to being your own coach? After all, people can see themselves in the mirror. It's funny you say that, Ergun. I always say coaching is about holding up the mirror and helping people see themselves in a way they otherwise wouldn't. What's your take, Sarah?
Yeah, no, I'm very similar. I'll use the analogy of a rearview mirror, right? Because we have blind spots, things that others see in us that we don't see ourselves. And study after study has shown that we feel we are better at understanding ourselves and how others see us than we actually are. So I think most of us will say that we're highly self-aware, but again, behavioral science has proven us wrong. You know, I'll put myself in that mix. But here's the thing. I actually like this question because I am a big advocate of do-it-yourself coaching. I don't think we have to wait for somebody else to help us navigate maybe a tough situation or propel us forward. And oftentimes in my workshops, I will give people links to resources like a book called For Your Improvement. It's an old book. You may have heard of it. And one called Compass by Center for Creative Leadership. And they're big fat books that have every competency you can imagine in them and suggestions for what to do to develop that competency, what it looks like when it's used well, what it looks like when it's underused, and other resources. So I am an advocate for coaching yourself, but here's the thing. I think even in that endeavor, you have to be willing to then ask people for feedback, because you're going to stop short of understanding what you think is happening versus how you're actually landing with others, either in your approach, your words, and even in your performance.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I often say that when I'm coaching, you know, part of my job is to ask good, tough questions. And part of it is to point out where someone might be contradicting themselves, where they say they value this, but they value that. And these values are crunching up against each other. And it's hard for them to choose. We got another question coming in from Tanya. Here we go. What do you think of viewing a coaching relationship as one where the employee and leader are equal? Should all answers come solely from the employer? Can they be provided by the leader to guide them?
These are such good questions.
Yep.
I am a big fan of co-creating solutions and action plans. In fact, I tell leaders all the time, don't take this on as your own. And I think that's why they stop short of doing it. It's very time consuming, and they feel like they have to have the right answers to help a person progress. And that's not the case, right? Sometimes you're just connecting them to the right people, or you're giving them the space to work on something that's more in line with where they want to go. But absolutely, I think there are certain parts of the coaching process that can be owned by both the coachee and the coach. When it comes to having the answers, so to speak, I think that they also can come from both. I always tell people, if I were to be graded on my ability to be a pure coach, I'm not sure I'd make an A. Yep. And here's why. I am someone who likes what they call the Socratic method, right? Where you start by asking questions.
Yeah.
But frankly, after one or two, I think it's perfectly okay to say, are you open to hearing what I think might be stopping you from being seen in this way, or what might be preventing you from making this presentation land with the kind of impact you want it to? Mm-hmm. And then imparting your opinion.
Yep.
You know, you're a leader, you have experience, you have wisdom. And frankly, I think a lot of people who are being coached, you know, after a while, it feels really gratuitous if you keep asking questions. Part of why they're coming to you is they want your perspective.
Yeah.
So it's a blend of both. So I'm glad Tanya asked that question.
Yeah. We've got two more that just came in that are really good questions as well.
Oh, good.
And as I tee them up, so in your book, you talk about the essentials of coaching. You talk about essentials and how to apply those. And then you cover beyond the essentials. As part of that, you know, that framework, we've got a question from Tate. Really large sales team. They're part of them are virtual. He might be taking too much time, making good strides. What's the right cadence? So maybe in the your framework, you can answer Tate.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, I think with coaching, you are constantly making assessments about your individual employees, and it depends on where they are. So I think it's perfectly okay to not necessarily use the FAIR matrix, right? I'm going to spend X amount of time with every employee a month. It's going to depend on where they are in their life cycle of their job. If you've got earlier career salespeople or new to the business or the product or the service, then they may need more of your time and attention. If you've got people who are, you know, maybe they even are new to the product or service, but they've been in the sales environment for years and they catch on pretty quickly. You're sensing that they've got things covered. Then maybe their coaching looks differently and the time you spend with them also looks differently. Mm-hmm. So it's very much about where is each individual in their own context of the sales environment, the product, the service, and the relationship to you. I hope that answers Tate's question.
And Tate, I'll throw this out to you. There's an old article in HBR called Trust in the Virtual Organization. I think it was written in the 90s. And it's so interesting because it talked about virtual teams way back then. And one of the things it talked about that was so fundamental, what we all know, is trust. And in this article, it said there is no substitute for occasionally getting out there and seeing people face to face. So it might be something interesting to take a look at. So again, thanks for all these questions. I've got another one here for you, Sarah, from Betty. And I want to ask it in conjunction with Betty. I see a lot of player coaches, especially in financial services. And personally, my opinion is I think it's a messed up model. I think it's really hard to be a player and a coach. And I love the analogy of when's the last time you saw a coach on the sideline of a professional team put a helmet on and run in and make a play? It doesn't happen. So, you know, I and Betty's asking about, you know, people that are new and that were coming from that. And I think, Betty, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'll bet you some of those people are being asked to continue to do their old job as well, as they take on supervisory experiences. So that's a big lead up to some questions, Sarah. And I'll kind of dump that on you and see what your take is.
Yeah, well, you know, it reminds me of a question about when you're coaching newer, greener staff members, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times I get the question, well, how can I coach them when really I'm in instructor teaching mode? And I have to be, because they're new, they're green, they don't know a lot. The advice I would give them would be the same advice I would give Betty, in that give them a project or a what I call a real play instead of a role play, where you give them an opportunity to practice their coaching skills. And then that way you can coach them on their coaching conversation, right? And how it went. So if they never get a chance to try it and they're just put out there, is there a way you can create an opportunity for them that you can actually observe? And then that way you can point out, for example, you know, you did great here. You asked a question, but then you moved immediately into fix it mode. And that's one of the dangers we run into as coaches. We want to try to stay away from fixing it right up front. May need it eventually, but right up front, if you could ask a few more questions to see if they might come to the solution themselves before you jump into fix it.
Yeah.
Right. So,
You're making me think of the drama triangle, where you've got a hero, victim, and villain, and you never want to be the hero because it's all temporary. You right. want to be the coach, because if you enter the drama triangle, everybody ends up becoming a victim.
Yeah.
And it's if you want to look it up, it's Karpman, K-A-R-P-M-A-N, drama triangle. There's some really interesting work out there about it. And I think most of us can relate to getting sucked into drama triangles. And you can do that as a, you know, a well-meaning coach. You can right. dive into things and again, you know, try to fix stuff instead of help people solve stuff.
Or, you know, it's probably very similar, Jan, about, you know, what I call getting bogged down in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So you start coaching and then you start asking, it's like, well, why did you say that? Well, then what did he do? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure I would have done that, right? Because we're looking backwards.
Right.
And that is about getting caught up in the story. So we have to be very careful not to get into fix-it mode, not to get caught up in the story, not to come with our biases, right?
Yeah. And well, don't you think a big part of this, this is what I hit on a lot, and I'm really interested in your opinion. People want to correct things and they forget that they can't correct what people think, feel, or believe. And I often say the only thing you can really coach are observable behaviors, observable. And hopefully those observable behaviors are tied to the core values of the organization. And if the organization and the coaches haven't taken the time to figure out the observable behaviors and how those tie to the core values, to me, it makes coaching really difficult, because we're saying, well, you know, you need to act with integrity. It's like, well, what's integrity mean? Well, it means risk saying what you think in meetings. You can't, being quiet in a meeting is not acceptable around here. Here's the value that talks about, you know, integrity. I mean, and I see a lot of that, you know, being missed, because again, people are trying to coach what people think, believe, you know, and feel. And it's, I mean, we can't. What's your thoughts there?
Well, I think it's interesting because I would say that there are things that keep people, well-meaning, well-intentioned professionals, from reaching their full potential. I mean, and that sounds trite, but I do believe that. And sometimes it can be their belief system. And you can open the door to helping them discover how their belief systems might be getting in the way, or how their typical approaches, customary approaches to things. And one angle that I think you can use, if you don't use the value system of the organization to map back to your coaching, is simply, what does that person want for themselves? Mm. Right? So if you start by saying, you know, here's what I observed in the meeting yesterday, you know, and here's the outcome I observed as a result. Was that your intent? Or, you know, I don't think that was your intent, and you get a no, it wasn't. Then you can say, well, tell me what kind of impact you wanted to have in that meeting. Let them tell you.
Yeah.
And you can then ask, well, do you think there was anything that kept you from being perceived that way? And you can do this with anything, right? Yeah. And they either may have an idea, they may not. And then your next question is critical. Hmm. Are you open to hearing what I think is preventing you from reaching the next level?
Yeah.
And it's a very disarming statement. I don't think it's gratuitous. I think it's a genuine question. And then you've been given the open door. And I think people are more open because it's what they want for themselves. It's not what you're telling them they should do, right? And so it makes a big difference. And that's how I always advise people to coach, if there isn't a clear pillar, roadmap, guiding principle to match their coaching to.
Yeah. And I think you answered a little bit of Greg's question about favorite questions. I can tell you one I've been asking some of the CEOs I work with, because let me see, Sarah, if you think this is a good question. I've been asking, hey, you know, Mr. or Mrs. CEO, what do you think is the most important thing that you do? And are you getting better at it? And it's been interesting because they sit back and they go, oh, God, there's like 10 things, right? And what they end up getting back to is the thing that they can control is, well, communicate. I've got to get better at communicating the vision, the strategy, you know. And the only chance I have is one-on-one with people or in groups. I got to be better at communicating. And then they start they go, I need to have white space in my calendar so I have time to prepare for these meetings. And it's kind of, that's where those questions seem to go. To me, it's interesting. What's your thought on that question? And what's one of your favorite questions?
No, I love that question. You know, I think the only difference, or the only way I might phrase it is, what do you think from others' perspectives is the most important thing you do?
Oh, that's good.
For others, or what's the most important thing you do for those that follow you, you know, something to that extent.
Yeah.
You know, and then I might follow it up with, what do you think, you know, or if it's, how do you think you're doing in this particular area? Let's say it's communication, then I would follow it up with, how do you think other people, or what would they say about your communication skills, or how you communicate, right? So that you're getting people to see that it's not only their perspective, but how others actually experience them.
Yeah, I like that. On our Crucible expeditions, we always talk about direction, pace, and tone. You know, we got to go up to the top of the mountain. Pretty simple, straightforward. The pace is, we can only go as fast as the slowest person. That's pretty simple. The next thing is, how do we want people to feel when they get there? Deflated, demoralized, or ready to go do another one? And right. I say that to business leaders all the time. When you leave the room, how do you want people to have felt, you know, to feel? And That's just, it's overlooked a lot, is, you know, thinking about how we want people to feel, our effect on other people.
Right.
What, Sarah, what do you think, you know, what's the most common issues you think people are grappling with from a coaching perspective? Is it the difficult conversation? Is it they're not praising enough? I mean, what do you think are the most common?
Well, I mean, I think I'm processing this question a couple different ways, which is one, what might be keeping people from doing more coaching, right, as a leader? And I think the obvious is time. But I think the other not so obvious is, I think leaders feel reluctant because they're not sure that they would do it well enough, right? It's typical of leaders to feel that they have to be the subject matter expert, to do things perfectly, to do them well. And so they start to hesitate around having some of these coaching conversations because they're not sure quite how to do it. You know, we make assumptions that leaders have been given the tools and the guidance that they need to do it well. And so I tell leaders, just try one thing, do one thing differently in your coaching conversations. That could be start using more questions. But by the way, I do have a course on LinkedIn Learning on coaching skills for managers and leaders as well. And I bring that up to say, in that course, I have a list of questions. I want to be helpful. So if you want help on some really juicy, really good open-ended questions, you can tap into that course, or at least just go to the handouts section and find those questions. So try one thing on. I mean, even if it's a mindset shift, maybe that's the one thing you try on. I'm going to go into this coaching conversation with no expectations, with coming from curious and trying not to come in with any biases about how well this person's going to receive this conversation, even if it's just a development conversation. Maybe you're trying that on, right? You're just going to come in with a different mindset. There's all kinds of things you can do. Come in with a framework that you haven't used in the past. So that's one. In terms of the types of coaching that I think most trumps a leader is absolutely would be a difficult conversation to have, right? And it's actually typically more around a leader's observation of, or somebody else's, of somebody's behavior. Because if they're not making metrics, right, if they're not hitting their numbers, if they're not turning things in on time, those are pretty cut and dry, although people tend to shy away from those as well. That would be performance coaching, but it doesn't have to feel like a corrective action talk. I think that's why we avoid it. But even when they observe behaviors, and that's because I think subconsciously we know that others just want to be accepted the way they are. And they feel like bringing it to somebody's attention might feel like a personal attack. And we feel that way because we're processing it the way we might take it. Right. And so if you can just get over the hump that really in the long run, people do want to learn and grow. And the only way they're going to do that is with substantive feedback, real-time feedback, then you have to enter it that way. In this idea that I'm really doing this for the benefit of this person. Now, having said that, I also tell leaders there's sometimes you got to ask yourself, all right, does this person, would they really benefit from this feedback? Or am I in sort of a loop here where I'm like, oh, got to give them feedback, right? Because I think that can be just as harmful. So to be genuine around that principle, you really have to ask yourself, could this feedback really help this person? Because it continues to get in the way of something I know they want for themselves, for example.
I remember getting coaching training a long time ago. And one of the first things they had in the steps was, is this worth your time and effort? Like, is this necessary to bring this up? And, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, what I found with people getting ready for difficult conversations is they're focused on what they need to say. You know, you need to fix X. And my guidance, my coaching to them, to coach, is always, you don't have to call that out. Ask them, you know, hey, how do you think that meeting went?
Oh, right.
You know, what about your interaction with Brian? How did, you know, oh yeah, I was interrupting him a lot. Yeah. Hey, how do you think that made Brian feel? You know, that's a lot easier than basically going, hey, quit interrupting. You're being a jerk. I mean, you know, it's confrontational. I mean, you're coming at it as someone I know always says, you don't need courage to have a difficult conversation. You need compassion and candor. But that compassion, you know, is, you know, that you really care about somebody and you're, you know, that's why you're given the feedback. And I've even found myself early in my career where I would say, you know, in the middle of the conversation, I would say something to the effect that I was awake all night thinking about this conversation because I care about you and I wanted to get this right. You know, I let them know I was human and that I wasn't perfect. I wasn't going to get all the words right.
Absolutely. No, I think that's great. Again, that's just the way we start a conversation, especially a coaching conversation, can dictate the rest of the entire conversation and how it goes and the way the person feels and the experience you're creating. In fact, you mentioned earlier that I have, you know, three parts of the book, and one is, you know, applying the essentials and then beyond essentials. What I did in this book is I created what I called powerful phrases around each of the steps in the coaching model. Because again, sometimes it's just the getting started, right? I talk to a lot of leaders who they're really good at coaching, but they would still love to have some tips on how to start the conversation, right? Because it can make all the difference in the world.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, and we're getting toward the end of our time, you know, the whole idea of praise. I mean, we always think of coaching as difficult conversations and we're correcting behavior, but we know that there's not enough praise, and you've probably seen the research, you know, 5 to 1. For people to feel they've been treated fair. 5 attaboys or attagirls to every, you know, negative thing. And they say for marriage, it's 7 or 10 to 1. I can't remember. But I mean, do you subscribe to that? That, you know, part of the coaching is we're not catching people doing things right enough, you know, where we're truthful and timely and specific and personalized in our feedback?
You know, I do think that's true. I don't think you can argue with employees' feedback. And I've seen the research and I've seen the studies. And so it is hard to ignore that employees just want to feel valued, that their contributions matter. But I think there's a couple of different ways to do it without just outright saying, good job, right? To really put your money where your mouth is, number one, do what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. Coach your employees around their progression. That shows you really care about them, right? And number two, give them opportunities to do things that most align with what makes them tick, right? If you really value an employee and you just keep saying good job, but you keep giving them projects that are just soul-crushing, soul-sucking projects, then your words mean nothing, right? So there are other things you can do, I think, rather than the traditional, you know, monthly praise and awards that show that you care more than just the classic appreciation tokens.
Yeah. A really good question just came in, Sarah. I'm so glad this one came in because you know, I always say team two is relatively straightforward, the people that report to you. Team one, the team that you're on, that, you know, where you are with other peers and you have your manager, your VP, your CEO, whomever, is a lot different, and even coaching your manager. And when I coach CEOs, probably I'll bet you 50% of the time is talking about managing the board. So everybody's got a boss. Everybody's trying to manage up clients, whatever. Any advice for Ahmed here?
Oh, I am so interested in your response here. I just had this question the other day, and I'll tell you, the way I responded may not have been popular, but I don't know that we call it coaching your boss. I think we call it managing up,
right?
Because let's face it, male or female, we are also talking about egos and about protecting others' egos. Yep. And I don't mean just because they're the boss. I think everybody comes to the table with an ego, and your boss is no different. Your manager is no different. So I think it would be presumptuous to think that we're coaching our leaders. I think what we can do is maybe manage our leaders. But what's interesting, you can use the very same technique you use with your coachees, which is to go into a meeting with your boss and say, so how do you think that communication with my team, let's say they visited your team, and you can say, how do you think that meeting went? How did you sense people reacted to your latest initiative? Right? Yeah. Start there. You start the same way. Now, you don't necessarily say, I'd like to tell you what I think, but maybe you could come at it from, well, here's what I was sensing, right? They may not have asked your opinion, right? You're hoping to open the door that they would turn around and ask you the same thing. But even if they don't, say, well, you know, I'd like to tell you what I was sensing, or maybe the, some of the feedback that I was given as a result of the meeting.
I go back to my sales days. And I remember from my sales days, there's an organizational objective with a customer or a prospect, and there's a personal one. The organizational one might be, you know, we've got to hit our numbers. The personal might be, I don't want to let the team down. You know, I want to build the equity for the people. I promised the board I'd hit this number. I mean, I don't want to look like a chump. You know, I haven't hit my numbers in 3 quarters. There's always a personal one. And I think when we're coaching, we've always got to know what motivates people, what drives them, what they want. And I think the same thing for our boss or our superior, whatever, is let's really understand what they want and let's help them get it. And again, I don't think that's sucking up. I think that's being prudent because as, you know, I mentioned Jeff Pfeffer before. What he would say is job one is to keep your job. You know, if you don't have the job, you can't do anything. The other part is when you have the job, I think you've got to figure out how you exert power and influence that, you know, regardless of where you're at in the organization, everybody has some degree of leadership responsibility, which is to get people to do things they otherwise wouldn't do willingly. Otherwise, everything's just, you know, a machine, status quo. And of course, you know, it's humans. There's a million variables. We're not machines. And so the only way to me to do that is to tap into what people want. So, yeah. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And, I'm thinking of leaders who, you know, they may know what their boss wants, right? Yeah. But for whatever reason, they know that their boss is not connected maybe to their team's challenges, their team's perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to find a way to create a forum where you can share those so that they have a broader context.
Yep. Well, let's see if we can wrap this up, Sarah. I mean, we could go for hours and questions are so good. Well, first off, I want to thank you for writing the book that's so, so needed right now, because in the old days, you know, people got lots of training before they were thrown into leadership roles. And these days it doesn't work that way. You do a good job, you're thrown in and you're expected to figure it out. and it's hard. And, you know, so personally, I encourage people to have coaches and mentors and lots of mentors and lots of coaches and lots of different perspectives, because this stuff is hard.
It is.
Your book's published through McGraw-Hill. I put your website in the feed. It's on Amazon. There's lots of places to get it. You're on LinkedIn. So I want to make sure people, you know, get out there and you know, get this resource. What would you like to leave with everybody as a challenge or a final thought that would be helpful, given that, you know, we are in difficult times?
Yeah, I think I go back to what I said earlier. Even myself, I know that I tend to cling to what I've always done and what seems to have worked for me in the past when I'm stressed. When things get more chaotic and more complex, I tend to want to hold on to my cadence, to the way I organize things, when really that is probably the complete opposite of what we should be doing. We should be trying on new things because we've got new problems and new complexities. Yeah. So even if you just try on one new thing as it relates to coaching, right? I mentioned this in passing the other day. I was doing a workshop and one of the leaders was just like, oh, I love this idea. Hold open office hours. Right? We don't have an open door policy anymore because we're not physical. So once a week, tell your team, I'm going to be on Zoom from 10 to 11. I don't have an agenda. I'm just going to be working. If you want to hop on and ask me a question or explore an idea, do it. And anybody's willing to come listen, we'll just process anything. And that in and of itself could give you an opportunity to try on some coaching skills, right? Yep. By asking more questions instead of just immediately having the answer. So that's just one idea. Try on one thing.
Yeah, it's so great, because what you're asking people to do is really jump out of their comfort zone a little bit. And, you know, again, that's what we have to do. That's our obligation to ourselves is, you know, stretch ourselves. So this is fantastic. Again, thank you for, you know, all the contributions you make. I follow you on LinkedIn. You're always putting out great stuff, and you're an inspiration, not just to a lot of people, but to a lot of other LinkedIn learning instructors.
That's so nice of you to say. I'm honored to be here. I really am.
Good. Well, thanks everybody. And, on behalf of Sarah, we want to wish everybody just a wonderful Thanksgiving and a great holiday season coming up. And you know how to reach us.
Yes. Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.